When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome again to Knife Talk Podcast. I am Mareko Malmasi, and as always, I'm here with Mr. Craig Lockwood, the illustrious Mr. Craig Lockwood of Chop Knives. And usually we're here with Jeff Fader, but he's got an sandblasting
issue at the moment.
Sorry.
It's not normally a problem for us. Normally that's a Wednesday night for him, he's ass blasting.
Right.
But you had to move it this week.
It got slightly delayed. So yeah, Thursday morning. Thursday afternoon, we're recording. And anyways, we're here to give each other a hard time, whether it's on purpose or on accident. We're here to answer questions, work through your dilemmas, help you troubleshoot your knife making. Just all the stuff you got going on knife making. And, you know, it's a podcast for makers of all varieties, as well as just people just generally interested. So thank you for joining us. And I would like to kick it off by asking Mr. Craig how the last week has been, sir.
Okay, I can't complain. I launched quite a big project that I've been working on for some time, non-knife related. It's a music festival, it seems to be received quite well. So I'm pretty pleased. And we're sort of releasing an artist a day. And once we've got our full lineup released, then we release the tickets. So we're sort of teasing things up a little bit. And yeah. It's good. It's all my favorite music from the 90s, basically, all those bands. So it's good, but it's just been hectic dealing with like agents of people.
Okay, so you're an organizer. You're not just like excited about this thing.
No, I'm doing it. This is my thing.
That's crazy. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So, you used to do a lot more organizing and coordinating of large events like this.
Exactly. Yeah. It was in the sort of design world previously. Yeah. Yeah. So sort of using the context I have in the music business to put on a music festival and dealing with like agents of artists who think they're far more important than they are it's been a struggle. Being like urgent written on the top of an email, you open it and it's just like something pathetic, you know, and it's just like, oh man, they're all arguing over who's going to be top billing. I'm like, whoa, like, you know, there's a transaction happening here. We're paying you to come and play, you know, leave everything else to us kind of thing, you know?
Right.
And, oh, man, it's been a bit of a headache. But
ego's flying, it sounds
yes.
like a little bit.
But we're over the line. We've got everybody signed contracts, and now it's just, releasing stuff, ready to get tickets out, really.
That's great. Dude, that sounds so cool. I can't even imagine where you would even start. I mean, it sounds like you got contacts in the music industry, but holy shit, to organize a music festival. And where is it? Where's it going to be?
When I say festival, let's dampen things down a little. It's an indoor thing, but we do actually have the whole venue. So we have like their courtyard, and we have food trucks, and so we have like a number of bars. There's a cocktail bar and all that. And it's all sort of walled off, so it's all ours.
Yeah.
But it's only 1,500 people, so it's not massive, you know. And it's really a tester event for something bigger we've got in mind for next year, which will be a full-on 3-day festival camping the lot, you know. So it's just sort of testing the waters with that, and it's fun. I'm enjoying it, but it's Yeah, it's a different world, and you've got a lot of egos. And not so much the artists have been great. It's their fucking agents who are an absolute nightmare. Absolute nightmare.
Well, isn't that the agent's job, though, is to be the asshole? Because they're, you know, they're trying to earn their, whatever, 3 or 10% or whatever, right?
Up to 20%, I believe, with some people. Yeah. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're just trying to show some sort of value. But they're just getting in the way. Like, yeah, it's a bit of a pain. But that's really sort of, that's been my whole week, really. Gearing up for this and the sort of starting to release acts. So
that's very cool. I just saw that you posted about one of the first acts. Or just not one of the first acts, but just one of the first artists that you.
Yeah, so announced. We've done two so far, and we're going to do one a day for the next 8 days.
We've got eight
bands playing. It's like an all day thing, which is, yeah, it's going to be cool.
And where did you say that is this happening in Wales, or is this
in Cardiff? Yes, okay. Where the town I'm from. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so want this to become like Cardiff Woodstock?
No, well, not quite. So this is in the city, but I've got no. It's basically going to be in the countryside. A big festival. Okay. That's the plan, long term plan, next year onwards. Yeah,
that sounds like fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm getting just to indulge myself by just booking all the bands that I enjoyed myself in the 90s, you know? And, you know, that's the music I'm into, so it is quite cool, yeah.
Well, and so, all right, so there's music, there's food, there's drink. Are there going to be also, like, booths for merch or artisans?
For merch, for the artists, basically. Okay. Right. Yeah, and that's a big part of their revenue, these, you know, for artists, merch and stuff like that. So
sure.
It was part of all of their contracts. They all had, you know, we need a stand for our merch and stuff. It's like, yeah, so we're sort of manning a stand and everybody put their merch on there so they don't have to, you know, get their hands dirty kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, all these little things you need to think of, you know, and I don't know, it's fun. It's just taken up a lot more time than I thought it would, but it's been fun. And this has been going on for weeks and weeks. This isn't something that, you know, just this week happened. This has been going on for months in the sort of background. But now I can finally talk about it because now we're telling people who the artists are when we're sort of, you know, getting email addresses ready for the big ticket launch.
Yeah, that's super exciting. And like you said, you've done this before with tech and stuff and organizing big events. But this is your first music event?
It is. Organizing yes. like this? It is. So I'm doing it with a friend. So Nick, who produced my single, who produced a lot of these Britpop bands back in the 90s, all the Oasis stuff, the Stone Roses stuff, and all that kind of stuff. We've become pretty good buddies. So we're doing it together. So it's sort of his contacts in the industry and my experience running big events.
Yeah.
And it seems to be working. It's just a 50-50 split of both the work and any sort of profit. So, yeah, it seems to be working well.
That's exciting. I'm pumped for you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just every time my email pings, I'm like, what the hell is this now? You know? But no, it's all good. It's all good.
Nice.
So your week, what's been going on in Mareko's world, in Sword World? Are you still on Swords?
Sword World, yeah. Oh, yeah. Playing with swords nonstop. I am continuing to make progress on some of the pattern elements, and I had a really good, so today when we do record the podcast, is usually a pretty busy day lined up with a business meeting, and then we do the recording, and then we usually have other stuff planned in the afternoon with the family. And so I had a good chat with the wife, just trying to figure out what the direction is I'm trying to go with this whole sword thing.
Did anybody reach out last week after you saying that, you know, you want to find some links with museums, that kind of thing?
Sure, yeah. I definitely did find, I got a couple messages from folks trying to help, which was very, very much appreciated. Thank you. Just to recap, if you didn't hear last week's episodes, basically I'm working on these ancient Roman sword patterns that were unearthed about 180 years ago in Denmark. Nobody's been able to figure out how to make those patterns until now through me. And so I'm figuring out what to do with this knowledge, basically. And do I work with an archaeologist or art historian? Or I don't know who the hell I would work with to figure out how to share this understanding in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
And so that's what people have been messaging about. And that's what the conversation today was about. Because I would love to get work into some of these museums. There are at least two I am aware of, but probably more, where some of these swords are housed. And often, especially like back when the Ulfborg sword, back in, I think it was 2011 with Rick Fuhrer, came out, it was like a Nova presentation, and it was about the Ulfborg swords, which were these Viking Age swords, but they were made from crucible steel from Indonesia, and talking about the whole trade route and all the process and everything that went into it, and trying to really understand, because these swords were like the pinnacle of Viking swords, the most high performance Viking swords at the time. And so for these Roman patterns, or these Roman swords with these unique mosaic patterns on them, these were like the pinnacle of sword blade ornamentation. There was like a new technology and process and techniques that were developed just to make these very specific swords for really, honestly, a very short period of time before then they were basically shoved out by more high performance steel, like the crucible steels that the Ulfborg swords and stuff were being made from. It's just better steel. And like these mosaic Damascus swords, like it's taking long enough for me to do this on my own with modern tools and technology. I cannot even imagine how many people and how much material and how much time it would have taken for them to do this in ancient Rome. But they also, you know, they were a machine for fucking sure, and so they probably had a way of figuring that out.
Yeah.
So
I could see this being like a short Netflix series, or even like a YouTube channel of, you know, really high quality videos where you're explaining this kind of thing, as well as, you know, interspersing with footage of how it's being made and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
I imagine historians would be losing their shit over that.
Well, I think it would be really cool, and I think that's what the conversation with my wife was today. It was like, what are we really trying to accomplish with this? Like, what is the story we're trying to tell? How is this meaningful to anybody in general? And then figuring out how to tell that story, and also to do a bit more research to get like solid resources and references, specifically to, you know, more scientifically based like archaeological articles and stuff based in history and whatnot, and just kind of marrying all those different aspects of history together to then tell the story of these blades, basically. And so we're figuring it out. I think it's still going to be a ways down the road, especially after today's conversation, but I would really love to. I'm honestly, like, my biggest thing, my egotistical situation is like, I've rediscovered how these swords are made. I'm the first person to properly reproduce and accomplish these techniques in almost 2,000 years. And I just want credit at the very least for figuring that out. And at the same time, like, part of me is like, you small person, like, why the fuck do you even care about getting credit for this? But at the same time, it's like, it has been a lot of like very intense thought and experimentation to figure this out.
And so you should get credit. I mean, you know, as much as we all say we don't, everybody has got this sort of legacy that they want to leave. And this would be a hell of a legacy, you know? Have you spoken to Alec, Alec Steele? Because
he had
his Discovery Channel. I can imagine them lapping this up.
Yeah, I messaged Alec a while ago with kind of like a soft proposal of how something might be able to be put together. And we've messaged a little bit, but it's kind of dropped off, and so I got to reconnect with him.
And
see what his interest is. But there are other potential resources that I'm looking at connecting with and talking about, making the possibility of kind of doing this whole storytelling and presenting this in a meaningful way. Because it is very interesting, and it's interesting too to think about, like, you know, these swords were so labor intensive that only the absolute elite, highest paid, fancy pants warriors and generals and whoever could have afforded them, because most weapons were just standard issue, like a standard issue rifle to a military today. It was just something that, you know, you handed back when you were done fighting, or if you died, it didn't go to your family or anything. It just went back to the military and it was reabsorbed and then redistributed.
Would these be like ceremonial, or would they actually be used for battle?
So these were actually used. These were swords that were actually used. And reading some of the scholarly articles written by people kind of studying the history around them, I think one of the prevailing belief or understandings of where these swords came from is that they were kind of spoils of war, basically. These tribes came down from Scandinavia, Denmark. They fought against Rome in some of the Germanic wars and stuff against Rome fighting the barbarians. And so when they would win, they would take the spoils of war. But they didn't. Some of the stuff, I'm sure, maybe some people kept, but these swords were then brought back to their homelands and they were sacrificed and destroyed. And so I don't know if it's kind of like a weird fuck you or and that's some of the stuff I need to learn more about and understand. But these are the kind of weapons like that the top generals of Rome were carrying on them. These weren't just like these basic dudes walking around in the infantry. Like, these were the upper echelon people, and so it's trying to figure out and kind of put that whole story together. And so I got a lot more research and stuff to learn and people to connect with, but I think it's coming together. And like I said,
stories sell
well, and I think it is pretty intriguing because there was a massive jump because pattern, I think I said last week, pattern welding had been happening for especially intentional pattern welding. There was incidental pattern welding happening, but that was, it was because people were just piling all these scraps of material together and trying to forge them and weld them together and make something out of them.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was being intentionally done as far back as like 500 BC and possibly even earlier. Which is a fucking long time ago. But it was in this very unique time where, and that was happening in Celtic cultures, especially these pattern weapons. And so then Rome comes through and absorbs these cultures. And then there's influence of Roman crafts and techniques that were, I think, picked up by some of these Celtic smiths. And there was like this interesting kind of confluence and marriage of these different techniques that resulted in these very unique swords that, again, were only made for a short period of, well, quote unquote, short period, 300 to 400 years. But in the span of all of time, it's a very short period.
Oh, yeah.
And then it was just completely dropped off until really in the last maybe 5 years. The swords that Jamie Lundell is making are probably the most similar to what those complex mosaic pattern swords were being made in ancient Rome.
So what point are you at? Have you got to like heat treat yet? Where are you?
I am still working. So I'm making elements for three swords. I have one sword billet almost fully assembled. It's been kind of, like I said, I've done a couple swords, but the construction on those ones were a little bit easier than the way I'm approaching this one, and this one's proving to be a little bit trickier, but I'm very close to finishing getting that billet assembled. And so once that billet is assembled, I'll forge weld everything together, and then I'll forge out a sword blade out of it. So hopefully... I'm sure I said last week, I'll have a sword next week, but I don't yet. hopefully that's happening sometime in the next couple weeks. I don't know. And then also Holly Loftus is in town in the area. She's been doing a tour around the United States. And so she's up in Bellingham hanging out with Bob Kramer. And then... And then she's going to do meet some other makers, and she's got a friend that she's meeting up with in Seattle. But anyway, she's going to be passing through, so it'll be exciting to have her at the shop for a day, maybe two, to just kind of hang out and
cool
do whatever. Very nice. That'll be fun, because often do you get somebody from like a quarter of the way around the world to come cruising through? So,
but very anyways, nice.
That has been my last week.
Awesome. Awesome. When you do come to heat treat, how are you going to heat treat? How long are these blades?
Oh, yeah, they are long blades. The blades overall from tip to tang to the end of the tang are on an average of about 30 inches. And so the blade itself is typically around 26 inches or so. Mm. Like 20, anywhere from 20 to about as long as, whatever. I'm getting too specific. Anyways, 27 inches. Some of them are really long, some of them are really short, but I will definitely be using my Even Heat Kill. I have an LB27 on end, and so I'll be heat treating that vertically. So I'll pull it right out vertically, and then boom, right down to my quench tank. And without that, I would be in a tough spot. I'd probably have to send it out somewhere to somebody who does more sword work.
So you're going to set your even heat vertically and almost dip the sword in?
Yeah, so I took the door off.
Got you.
And then I have a high temperature fabric, whatever you call it, kale wool, and a couple bricks. Yeah. And then so I have the bricks.
So you extend it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I have the bricks also kind of straddling the opening of the kiln, and it's just wide enough that the blade can slide through. And then I have a clamp tied on, or like a quick grip clamped onto there. And then also I'll grab the quick the clamp and pull it straight up down into the quenching oil, and then harden that blade, and we will move from there. But yeah,
let's just wait for the next full moon then. Yep. Okay.
Knife Talk is...
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say those solar winds really fuck things up.
Knife Talk is sponsored by Even Heat, the manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com.
Do it now. Okay, let's do some questions. Our lovely listeners, they've been sending questions to Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram, DMing us. And this first one is from Jonathan Spencer. He says, hello, my name is Jonathan, and I have a question. When you are designing a knife or coming up with a name for your knives, how can you make sure you're not copying being similar to someone else's design or name? That's something we've all come across, I'm sure. Sure. When I first started my knives, I got accused of copying somebody else's. To the point where they were threatening take me to court and all sorts, and it just definitely wasn't the case. And when I see other knives now, I can see certain elements of the knife my first knives were designed like, and the reason for that was the tooling that most of us have. We have this this 2-inch wheel at the top of the platen and the one at the bottom, and you see that little 2-inch mark, the transition between the blade and the handle there.
Yeah.
Lots of people use that. So it was that size. And mine was, and this other blade was. And it's just down to the constraints that we have, I think, that we all do something similar because we're all doing similar techniques using very similar machinery. So it is difficult. It really is difficult. And like we always say, there's only so many sharp and pointy shapes out there. But I think... for me personally, I spend a lot less time on Instagram now, looking at other people's knives, just because I don't want even to have to think about being influenced by others.
Sure.
And I think being influenced by others is fine anyway, but when you see a straight up copy of somebody's, it's never, never good. But I think the longer you sort of work at it, the more you're going to find your own sort of style and what works for you. I can look at a lot of knives and know, who made them, and that, little intricate details. And I'm sure Mareko's the same. You can look at a knife that you'll see online, and without even seeing the name of who it was, you'll know who it is. But maybe to the untrained eye, it's exactly like many other knives.
Sure.
But it is difficult. And when it comes down to naming, I mean, you know, it's pretty much the same there as well, really. There's not much you can do. However it speaks to you, call it that. That's all I can say.
Yeah. I feel like the standard go-to is just like your last name or part of your name and knives.
if you can't think
of it. Because honestly, I've seen people get really abstract with names. And it's like, first off, like, it's confusing. It's like, what does that word even fucking mean?
Yeah,
it doesn't. Yeah. And I think some people are trying to be too fancy or too whatever, like sophisticated. But if it only causes confusion, then that's not helpful. So I think be careful on that end of things. But naming, you know, like mine's Malmossy Fire Arts, or I could have gone Malmossy Knives or whatever. But it's when you say that, it's like, it sounds like somebody, and you're like, okay, well, who is this person? And you want, I mean, most people will probably be generally interested to find out more. Regarding that person, I don't think you've ever told me who that is, but I'm pretty confident I know who it is. And if it's the person I'm thinking of, they can fuck right off, because if anybody's ever seen the work by Joel Berkowitz at Cut Brooklyn, this motherfucker who's busting Craig's balls,
right. You are right.
Is a straight fucking ripoff, and I hope he's listening right now and he understands. You're straight ripping off Joel Berkowitz, and so you got no fucking ground to stand on. Fuck you. Anyway.
Yeah. But with regard to names, I thought I was being quite clever, actually, getting Chop.
Sure.
Because there was a Chop knives out there, and it wasn't, there was nothing up. Nothing up.
Okay.
So I managed to track down the guy who owned the domain. And he said, oh, you know, I registered this like 6 years ago. I've just been renewing it every year. I've never got around to actually making any knives. And I said, well, could I buy it from you? And he was like, yeah. So I bought it from him. And I thought, this is a really great, great name, I thought. You know, it's short. It's exactly what it is. But the problem with it, it's just not Googleable at all. If you Google Chop Knives, it's an action a knife will make. And
yes.
You'll find, you know,
so
it gets buried. It gets buried. But what I do like is, you know, I'd like to think of my sort of designs as being quite bare and quite sort of modern.
Yeah.
And not too much going on. And I think just having Chop on that sort of works, because it's, you know, it's just four letters. It's quite clean. So it works in that respect. But yeah, with regards to a name, you want to try and make sure that it's unique. Because Chop Knives certainly isn't unique.
Yeah.
Even to the point of there's lots of other Chop Knives out there now since that I've seen. And, you know, it's people who had the same idea as me, basically. You know, it's great for a knife. It's what you do with a knife. But, yeah, it doesn't really work for, you know, the way we search for things online.
Sure. And when it comes to search, I mean, what is it? I can't think of it. Jared Thatcher. He was, I think it was Queensland...
Yes, yeah, there's something going on with that, I remember, Queens, yeah.
But it
was
somebody else's brand already. Mm. And honestly, if you're worried that you might be using somebody else's name, Google is a very powerful tool for figuring that out. Especially if you just say whatever, knives. If it comes up, then it's somebody else's thing. And so, you know, you can name it after your dog, you can name it after the street you grew up on. I don't care. I mean, that's what's great about Blenheim Forge. Like, they're just named after the street they're on.
Yeah.
But is it very unique? You know, easily to search. There probably aren't a lot of Blenheim anything except for that fucking street and the knife making.
Well, and the palace. There's a huge.
Oh, is there a palace over there? I don't know.
There is a small area. Yeah.
I don't know anything about the area. Sorry, guys.
It's England. There's palaces everywhere. You know what it's like. Yeah.
Screw the English. but yeah, when it comes up to designs, though, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with taking inspiration from stuff. And I think the big problem has always been when people pretend like they just came out of nowhere with it. And like you said already, Craig, like there are a bit of limitations with shapes and handle shapes and even just like the combinations of handle material or type of finish, like all the various aspects there, it's kind of limited. It's hard to really push yourself outside of the typical bounds of what makes a knife and the stylistic choices and stuff. And if you do take inspiration from somebody, I think the thing is to just be transparent about it. Because honestly, like, your biggest supporters are likely to be other knife makers. And if other knife makers see you acting like you just came up with this style of knife, but it's a straight ripoff of Don Nguyen's work, then they're going to tell you to fuck off. Like, you're not going to get their support. Even though they're not your target demographic, they're not the people who are buying your work from you, it does really help to get the support of makers around you. Because I know, like we do on this podcast, and I do myself, like, I share other makers' work, but it's people whose work I respect and I appreciate the creativity or unique things they're doing, but they're always acting with integrity. And I think that's the hardest thing. Unfortunately, it sometimes seems very difficult for people to act with integrity because they want to feel like, I came up with this thing, but the reality is, like, you probably didn't, unfortunately. I think that's where we've talked about in recent episodes, where also, like, the story we were saying actually earlier in this episode about the sword, but your story, the brand you develop on top of everything else is also going to be a major selling point. So it's not just the stylistic choices, but it's like who you are as a maker and as a person in the world, that will help influence or inspire people to want to get work from you.
Yeah. Very good point. Okay, do you want to take the next one from Falcon Knives, AK?
Falcon Knives, AK says, hey guys, here's the dilemma. I had someone purchase a large order from me and must have had some buyer's remorse a few days later because they wanted to return the knife set. The set was about $3,000 and I use Square, which takes roughly 3% card transaction. If I return the customer's money, I lose out on that 3%, which would be $90. Should I charge them the credit card fee and return the rest, or just suck it up and take the hit? Thanks for the advice, Kurt Komyari.
We've never had that question before, actually. That's a good one.
Yeah.
I think you've got to get to the bottom of why they wanted to return the knives. So there could be a bigger issue there anyway. But I mean, I think it would be difficult to try and charge them that fee too. So I think when you're pricing up, I think you need to sort of build that cost in. Mm-hmm. In case this happens. But the fact that you're doing a refund, that doesn't really... That's a really difficult one.
Sure.
I don't know, and I don't know what I'd do in that situation either. I think I'd try and have it out with them, but you know, trying to understand why they're returning the knife. Because unless you've had some sort of contract beforehand, you're not obliged to, you know, have the knife returned and give the money back. But if they're not happy with the knife, then that you know, it's a different issue then.
Right.
But I don't know. With regards to the charge, I think you just got to swallow it, really, to be fair. It's, you know, hopefully it's a rare thing that happens for you.
For sure. Yeah, I agree. I think this might have to be, unfortunately, this one might have to be one you have to eat. But hopefully make it a lesson for making adjustments in the future. And I think part of that, which I've referred to many times, is our terms of use. When we send an invoice to somebody, part, you know, of the description of the knife and everything, or even if it's for a deposit, I have a link on there that says, by paying this invoice, you agree to our terms of service. That links to a terms of service page. That's all a bunch of legal jargon. But in there, you can fold in, you know, a certain percent, a 10%, you know, service charge, a non-refundable 10% service charge that you don't have to explain to them why it's there. You just say, there's a 10% service charge. Maybe that compensates you for materials or I don't know what, especially, or if somebody wants a return, that helps cover the cost, not only of the money coming in, but then the, you know, if there is a return, then it covers the return. And so hopefully that 10%, and then you just build that into the price.
Yeah.
But in your terms of service, that's just, it's there. it's covered by paying the invoice or however they, you know, make, I think that what's really important for it to be valid is that it has to be somewhere the person has an opportunity to see it. You can't just sneak it in, by the way, and like somewhere, like it has to be obvious. And that way it's fair. They have a fair chance to stop and change their mind and back out or whatever before any money or any work is done.
Yeah. You know, that's quite interesting. I've been doing this whole festival thing that I'm talking about, and we're putting tickets live next week. And it's quite normal for events and for ticketing for you to charge the customer for the credit card fee and whatever. You know, there'd be a booking fee.
Sure.
And it's quite normal for the customer to eat that. But I can't think of any other industry where we do that, where we all take card payments now, you know, and I think... Right. It's quite weird that nobody else does that, but it's completely accepted in the ticketing world.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like when we were first doing, me and my wife starting the business and first taking like digital payments or credit card payments, we were charging people the credit card fee. But yeah. Come to find out that is, I think, I don't know if it's just our state or the United States or whatever, but it's technically against the law to charge the customer the service or that credit card fee. But there are ways for people to build that in to their pricing so that it helps to, so that when you quote somebody a certain amount, that price, that amount is kind of built into that, so that, or into that quote, so that that is not a thing that you're losing out on just so that you can do business.
Yeah. I think like a restocking fee some people use.
Yeah, and it's changed. Like you can call it a shipping and handling. Like, because realistically, like it does take time, materials, and costs to ship and handle, like handle the whole shipping process of packaging and stuff. And some people build it into that as part of the shipping and handling fee. But I think the best way is just to charge a little bit.
Stop in and save big money on your next outdoor lumber project now at Menards. Menards has the largest selection of AC2 pressure-treated lumber and decking, and it's easy to load in our outdoor lumber yard. Plus, you can get free estimates fast with our deck design program in-store or on Menards.com. Check out our weekly flyer for more great deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Bit more for your work, because either direction that would have been $30, and $30 on top of $3,000 probably doesn't seem like very much, and who the fuck cares. But it would have helped prevent some of this pain of the back and forth.
Okay. Leroy A. Knives said, "Hey cuties, this is for Mareko and maybe Craig for sightseeing. There's an archaeological experiment going on at, I think it's Guidelin in France. They are building a castle from the 13th century from scratch, only using the tools and techniques available at that time.
That's cool.
There are blacksmiths on site. Maybe they could get the information you want on a publishing article, Mareko."
Yeah, and I think that would be very interesting. I don't know how far that is from you, but that would probably be pretty, at least possibly,
I don't know,
vaguely interesting long, for you to go see. I mean, France is a pretty large country, isn't it?
It is. Mm-hmm. And you can guarantee when you get there, they'll be taking lunch. Of course they'll be taking lunch. Or it'll be a holiday.
Nobody's even there.
Yeah, nothing will be going on.
Oh, my God. That's so funny.
We had another holiday again this week on Monday.
Oh, yeah. What holiday was that?
Well,
holiday
it's a weird
for holiday
one because
sake?
In the UK, they obviously had a huge holiday because it was the King's coronation.
Oh, right.
So it was a day off for everybody. But for some reason, we had one here in France as well. So it's who knows? They have a holiday for anything here.
That's funny. Trying to figure out. I think that's probably one of the things I'm missing as part of my puzzle right now regarding the swords is understanding more about the technology and techniques that were available at the time. To try to really understand some of the sudden advancements that were created or developed to be able to make these swords. So if people got information or resources for those books or I ideally picture books.
yeah.
That's very helpful to see. But also words are great. But yeah, picture books, articles, regular books. That'd be interesting.
Okay, before you do the next one from John Marston, okay. Let's tell people about these guys.
Combat Abrasives makes the world's best abrasive belts for knife makers, available in any size at unbelievable prices. Go take a look at combatabrasives.com and get 15% off with promo code KNIFETALK15. Do it now!
Do it now, exactly.
Okay. From John Marston. He says, hey, gents, I have a question that might turn into a dilemma. Do you think it would be safe to use G10 pin stock for a stop pin on a friction folder or use at least brass or some kind of metal? Now, stop. If you guys feel that's safe. Oh, sorry. I'm really struggling with reading right now. If you guys feel that's safe, then stop there. Let me explain. I overbuild everything, so when I see someone selling friction folders with G10 stop pins, I saw it as questionable. Then there's the dilemma. Do I say anything? If I do, how can I do so without sounding like a knife Karen, or just shut up and let them do their thing? What do you think?
So it's a stop pin, not a pivot pin. It's just the stop pin.
Yeah.
Personally, I wouldn't use G10, but I would use brass, and in fact, I have on the little folders that I did.
Right.
The only pin that wasn't brass was the actual pivot pin,
because
okay. Obviously that does a lot more movement, and that's more likely to break down. So that was a stainless pin.
Yes.
I can't see an issue with it really. What do you think, Mareko?
I think ideally metal would be most ideal.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, we abrade G10 nonstop, and I guess we can abrade brass as well, but it doesn't cut away maybe as easily. I don't know. But when it comes to, do you jump in and say something? Maybe if you really feel compelled to say something, maybe not project, but ask a question. Be like, oh, I'm curious about that stop pin. Are you concerned about it wearing down over time? But ultimately, yeah. If you don't know this person, it seems like a weird like armchair move to be out of left field and be like, hey, by the way, that's a bad fucking call, buddy.
So, I mean, if it's happened to you, if you've had one yourself with G10 stop pins and you've had a problem, maybe you could say something.
Sure.
But it sounds as if you haven't, and I can't really see it being a big issue anyway as stop pins, but hey, who knows? I mean, one of the things you may find there is if it's, you know, a lot of friction folders are all metal construction, and if you're just using G10 for the pins, if it's all metal, if there's any sort of movement, you know, temperature-wise, it'll generally all sort of move together. But if you're using a different material than it's just a G10, it wouldn't. So maybe that could be an issue, but I don't think it would be.
Yeah.
Karen. Karen Marston. You tell your husband, John, to stop sending us notes, okay?
Nice. Do you want to do this next one from Ben?
Benjamin Coffin. Benjamin Coffin, okay. Why hasn't somebody made an app for phones? So when you're hand sanding, you log in and it matches you with another bladesmith to chat with while you're both hand sanding. Sander, it could be called, without the E. Sander, like pretty much like Grindr, but you don't want to use Grindr when you're grinding, believe me.
Or would it be more like chat roulette?
Possibly. Yeah, maybe. Okay, yeah.
Would it be stroke roulette?
Light strokes, it could be called, yeah. Different strokes, different folks. Yeah. It would just be Will anyway. You always see Will when he's doing his hand sanding.
It'll just be him 24 hours. Will Stelter.
Yeah. just FaceTime Will Stelter. He'll be hand sanding. You're fine.
That's funny. Yeah, you log in and you're like, I'm hand sanding, by the way. Who wants the chat? Who wants the chat? Chat? Talk?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyways.
Do you remember when chat roulette first came out and everybody's a little bit curious?
Sure.
And it took about 15 seconds before a cock came on the screen basically every time. Gross. It's like, what? Unbelievable.
People.
Yeah.
If you are going to be doing some hand sanding, I know what Benjamin was doing here. If you're going to do some hand sanding, you got to go to Texas Ferry Supply and get yourself some Rhino Wet. Right? If you put in Knife Talk 10, that'll save you 10% on anything. I talked to Evan about this. It'll save you 10% on anything they offer at Texas Ferry Supply, including the world's best hand sanding paper for blades, Rhino Wet, Red Line. So go check them out. Go to, what is it, TexasFerrySupply.com?
.com, that's the one, yeah. Yep.
Put in Knife Talk 10, save yourself some of those ducats, and get some work done.
There we go. Nice one. EDC Gearhouse. You want to take that one?
Yeah, EDC Gearhouse. Are serrations added pre or post heat treat? As a knife modder, we get requests for serrations, but honestly, I just don't know how to add them in a unique way that isn't being done. Before heat treat, I'm guessing. When I've done serrations, the only time I've done them has been after heat treat, the same as I do any of my other finish grinding. It's a little trickier, obviously, because the material has been hardened, and if you overheat the material, it can really mess things up. I don't know. What do you think, Craig?
I've tried, when I first started serrations, I tried both. But I generally do most of my grinding post heat treat anyway. But my first serrations, they were pretty bad. They were very almost saw-like with real sort of teeth to them.
Okay.
And because you've got those really sort of fine teeth as opposed to sort of a scalloped edge.
Sure.
It was very hard to do that post-heat treat because that you've got such a small amount of material there for those teeth. They were going blue. They were heating up very, very quickly. Mm. But that was an error really in my grinding and the design as opposed to whether or not to do it, you know, post or pre-heat treat.
Okay, yeah.
Simply because the teeth. But I'd say definitely post-heat treat. Think scallops as opposed to teeth, I think, is the way to go.
Sure. Yeah, and different way, because so he mentions that they are they do these custom modifications to knives. People buy these knives. Maybe they're commercial, maybe they're custom made, whatever. I think a lot of them are typically like commercially manufactured. And then they modify them. They do, laser engraving. They anodize blades. They do stone washing, tumbling, all kinds of crazy stuff. They have some really unique and interesting, if you guys go to EDC Gearhouse, they've done some really cool modifications, but how to cut those, I feel like the serrations I typically see on, especially like folding knives, are pretty small, like maybe an eighth of an inch, and somewhat aggressive, because usually it's towards the, kind of the ricasso of the blade, and it's meant for catching and cutting rope. I don't know. I'd be curious what kind of unique way they're thinking they want to kind of cut those in. I wonder if you could use like a CNC but with like a Dremel bit or something. I don't know. Tooling would be fucking weird. I don't know how
I'd say for those for those small ones, I'd get almost like, you know, those sharpening systems, like the
the
Russian one years ago, where you have a rod, you know, and it keeps your angle steady.
You dangle? Is that what
it keeps your dangle steady? That's the one. But use maybe something like a chainsaw file on one of them. Okay. Because then you're going to get that angle right each time. You can have you'd be able to get, you know, a nice small sort of the size grind as well.
Sure.
I think maybe that could work, but it just seems like a lot of work. But I mean, if that's what you do, if you just do modifications anyway, possibly, yeah.
Yeah. I don't really have anything else. I'd have to look at EDC Gearhouse. Shoot me a message. I'd be curious to know more specifically what you are talking, what kind of serrations you're thinking of.
Yes, yeah.
You bring up chainsaw files. It made me think of Lockwood. Do you still have that bit of woods?
We do, yeah. Lockwood Woodward, we call it, yeah. Yeah, we do, because our house here is sort of powered by, in the winter, all our heating is by burning wood, like most of the houses around here, so... So we've still got it. We don't use it so much now as we did when we first had it, sort of recreationally, because we've moved and we're about 45 minutes away from it now.
I gotcha.
But I still go maybe once a month, check up on things.
Make sure nobody's poaching your trees.
Exactly. We have lots of fun actually with the kids. We put up like trail cameras in there. So then the kids go and retrieve them. We look at the footage, and there's always deer and pigs and stuff like that. So yeah, that's quite fun.
Go ahead.
No. We do. But yeah, every sort of January, you know, beginning of the month, we take a few trees down, cut it, and that'll be stored for a couple of years' time. Then, you know, so we've only just now started really burning the wood from the wood that we cut down sort of 2 years ago when we first had it. And it's a really nice feeling, actually, burning your own wood, because, you know, I haven't paid anybody for this, which is always nice.
Sure. I guess you take down, how big are the trees? Like, what's the diameter? How tall are they? Because
they're big.
Doesn't seem like a lot of trees.
Yeah, we've got, it's 5 acres, so it's quite a big big bit.
Yeah.
So there's half of it is almost like a nursery side where they're growing. The other side is bigger, and then the idea is then in sort of 10 years' time you switch and you go back and forth.
I got you.
But they're hornbeam. So the mature ones are maybe 18 inches thick.
Okay.
They're not huge like big oaks.
Sure.
I mean, there are some huge ones there, which we leave them because they are just big and they're lovely to be there.
Yeah.
But yeah, generally about 18 inches, those are the ones we're taking down. They're tall. They're very tall. Three is will give us, we do what we call stairs of wood here,
okay,
which is basically the meter long. And we do meter by a meter.
Okay.
And we generally go for about 15 of them a year, and 3 trees is more than enough for that.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah. So it's a lot of work. Actually, I really enjoy those days when we do that every year, but it is a lot of work. You're achy, and it is hard.
That's
work,
right. I forgot you were kind of like a bushman, or not bushman, but like a bushcrafter guy. Like, you like to go out into the wood.
Yeah.
Some coffee, set up a small camp, build a fire.
Yeah. Before the kids, it was something I did very regularly. But now we haven't got time to do anything. I used to do that quite a lot and, yeah, enjoy it. But, you know, other things come and take over.
Sure. You don't feel comfortable, like you don't feel like you could take the kids out there?
Oh, we do. In the hot sun, we don't, because there's ticks everywhere as soon as it gets to that time of the year. But like this time of the year now is great for it, actually. But it's perfectly safe. It's just time. We just haven't really had the time to spend that much time there this year.
I gotcha. Okay. Mm.
Okay, Sean Wilson. Hey, man, can I ask you a question? Usually I made Damascus out of 1084 and 15N20, as you've discussed. These work so well as they have such similar heat treats. But recently I made a wide 80 CRV2 with a thin 15N20 stock of Damascus. My question is, the 80CRV2 with its vanadium content requires an extra 45 degrees in the heat treat, as per the Knife Steel Nerds book. He says, so do I do the 1525 degrees or the 1480 that the 15N20 calls for? Or somewhere in between? He said these knives have been made for kitchen cutlery with a fine edge, think brisket slicer or a bone-in knife. Mm-hmm. So he's using, yeah, two different steels, two different heat treat temperatures. Where should he be shooting?
I feel like I'm going to be a dick right now. But he finishes it with saying these knives are going to be made for kitchen cutlery with a fine edge, think brisket slicer and boning knife. But I feel like those two knives would actually be the least likely to have the most refined edge in the kitchen. So maybe I'm splitting hairs. But the geometry on those knives, because of the likelihood of coming into contact with bone, would probably be a little bit more robust than your general purpose Santoku or chef's knife.
Yeah.
When it comes to the heat treat, I would say, you know, I would shoot from do the 1525. I think that would be fine. Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah, because I think the 1520, 1080, 1520 can be heat treated from as high up as like 1500. It's just when you do, once you get up to that kind of like that top end of the range, when you're holding the steel for long periods of time at that top end, that's when grain growth really starts to grow really fast. The difference between grain growth at 1500 or 1550 versus 1450, 1475, it's dramatically different. So, you know, get up there, get the temp, let it soak for 10 minutes, but don't let it soak forever. You know, get it out of there, quench it, and move on. You should be fine.
Cool. Okay, whilst we're talking Damascus, probably a good time to tell everybody about Dharmasteel. Dharmasteel.se online. They sell stainless Damascus with some beautiful, beautiful patterns. Really good guys there. We're currently doing a build along with them. I'm not sure if they have any pieces left. I know they did run out and they were working very hard to make more. If you follow them on Instagram, Dharmasteel Lab, they'll let you know when there's more pieces available, or if you DM them, I'm sure they tell you as well. But basically, a bunch of us are doing a build along. I said they did sell out. Hopefully, there's more. And over the coming weeks, we will be sort of explaining that process of our build along. I've actually cut mine now. Mine is cut. I'm ready to refine it, ready for heat treat. And I'm actually making a charcuterie knife. So everybody needs to make a culinary knife of some sort, but what you'll find is that the piece isn't huge, so everybody's got the same sort of limitation, which I'm quite enjoying. So it's gonna be fun to see what people are making. Have you got any idea, Mareko, what you're gonna make yet?
Yeah, I don't know. I was thinking about doing these shears, and I think it's too much to try to ask of this very small piece of steel. And so I'm going to go in a different direction. I'm probably going to make a chef's knife, but I will try to make it as uniquely me as I possibly can.
That's really what I think is going to be fun, just seeing what people are making. Sure. Because, as I said, there's a limitation that we've all got, which will just make things more interesting. And come the Dharmasteel Chef Invitational, which is their yearly sort of, it's almost like their annual award show, I suppose. Mm-hmm. They will be picking a winner as well, and there's prizes and all sorts for the winner. So it's going to be fun.
Yeah, I think the piece roughly is about 1.25 inches wide by about 8 inches long, maybe 7 inches.
But yes, about that. Yes, yeah,
and maybe only just under a quarter of an inch, or just over an eighth of an inch. So maybe 5/32 of an inch. Not very, not super thick. It'll be fun to see what people make from it.
Definitely. Definitely. I use Knife Print, knifeprint.com, who are one of our sponsors too, to help with the design. I like to try and sort of, you know, get templates of things beforehand, just so I can see the sort of the shape, how it'll look. And KnifePrint is great for that. So if you've never done any sort of CAD before, particularly sort of 2D CAD, which is, you know, it's far simpler than it sounds, especially at KnifePrint.com, because they've got special tools that you need, you know, for drawing the various shapes. Some of that quite specific to only knives that you wouldn't see in other CAD programs. You don't need any sort of licensing. It's all done in the browser. You get to save what you want. You can get to print out the paper as well, which I think a lot of people may overlook, which is really good because you can make your templates. But their main sort of service, I suppose, is then you can press print and they will either laser jet cut it or water jet cut it out. You pick the steel, the stock that you want, and they'll just mail it to you, which is like, blows my mind how that can happen this day and age, designing something in the browser and then get the physical product in the post.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. So go take a look at knifeprint.com. I used it for this Damascus the Dharma Steel build along, and I'm sure others will be doing too.
All right. We're ready for another question?
Let's do it.
This one's from Brody.
Brody, dude.
Brody. Question for you, Craig. Just curious on why you moved to France. And how long you live there? Cheers.
I think we covered this in a previous interview with Jeff on Jeff's Full Blast. Yes. Both myself and Mareko have had an episode on there where we sort of deep dive into how we got into knife making and basically, you know, our whole life really. but just to put it sort of shortly, I've been here 5, possibly 6 years now. My wife and I were in the UK. Both working for ourselves, we came to France. Her parents had a place here at the time. Sort of fell in love with the place and thought, well, we could do this. We're not tied to the UK in any way. We can work wherever we want. Didn't have children at the time. And we thought, well, bugger it, let's do it. So we booked 2 weeks to drive around France to find a house. And house prices are ridiculously cheap here. Ridiculously cheap compared to the UK, at least anyway. So yeah, we sold everything up in the UK and came to France, which sounds crazy, but I mean, we're 1 hour and 20 minutes on a plane,
right?
So you know, yeah, so where we were in Wales, it takes 3 hours to get to London, but you know, only 1 hour and 20 to get here in France. And so yeah, it was a bit of a no-brainer for us, really. Sure. Yeah,
that's like a.
And I'm weird.
Oh, go ahead.
We're now sort of, our children were born here. They all speak fluent French. It's, yeah, it's home now.
Nice. Yeah, I'm about, what is it? I'm trying to think of what an 1 hour and 20 minute flight, how far it gets me. I think it gets me to Bozeman, Montana, and Northern California.
Right. Okay.
So a couple states away, either direction. Not very far.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it sounds great, 1 hour and 20 minute flight.
Yeah.
But really, it's, you know, 1 hour to the airport. You've got to be there 1.5 hours beforehand.
Yeah.
It's a full day, really. Yes. But you know, knowing we can get back to see family, you know, that day is, you know, it's quite nice.
Yeah. All right, we got another one actually here from John Marston.
Karen Marston.
Do we even take it? No, I'm just saying.
Let's do it. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
he says, "Hello, gents. I have a question for you. Did you know how to sharpen knives before becoming a maker? And if so, when did you first learn how to sharpen a knife and who taught you?"
Well, I didn't I thought I did, but I didn't really. Before getting into that whole sort of culture of, you know, proper knife nerds. So my grandfather sort of got me, I wouldn't say got me into knives, but he always had like a collection of beautiful knives, and they were like his treasure in his drawer kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him buying me my first knife when, you know, I was a young boy. And as well as getting the knife, he got me like this little tiny stone. And when I say little, I mean sort of maybe 4 inches,
like you can hold it in your
by half inch. Yeah, 4 inches by half inch, you know, and this is just for a little pocket knife. So he'd show me how to sort of sharpen this knife with that. So in my mind, because I've been doing that since I was 10, I was thinking, I'm the king of sharpening knives, you know, I'm the king of it. But then you start making knives and you see what other people are doing. It's like, oh, Jesus, I didn't have a fucking clue what I was doing. But yeah, that was my introduction to sharpening, I suppose.
Yeah. Let's see. I worked in a restaurant, and at one of our kitchen meetings, the actually the restaurant manager, who didn't work in the kitchen, decided he wanted to offer us a knife care demo about how to properly hone and care for an edge. And it was okay. I think some of his information could definitely have been better informed. But it definitely, I think for the first time, that was the first time I ever had any information told to me about sharpening knives in general. Even though my grandfather had spent a lot of time kind of being a woodsy kind of guy, he would ride horseback through the woods and go hunting and stuff like that. I met him when he was very old. And so we didn't get really a lot of time to, kind of share some of that stuff about knives and woodcraft and or bushcraft and stuff like that. And so I didn't really get that from him. So this kitchen manager showed some stuff, and then I applied it like the next day when I was at the restaurant, and it worked. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And that was the first, but it honestly, like I said, it wasn't the greatest information. And after getting into knife making, when I worked for Bob Kramer, he gave me a lesson on stone sharpening. And then I kind of rolled with it from there. But it was more, the lesson wasn't super detailed. It was basically hold it like this and rub it on the stone like this, and then and didn't do it on the other side. Didn't really like get too specific into, maybe we talked about some degrees, like what degree angle, but not necessarily like why. And I think that's what I really honestly struggled with for a really long time, and I'm actually still learning about. Sean Houston on Instagram, he's Triple B Handmade. He's got a lot of really great information about sharpness and edge retention and sharpening, and Kasumi Kev as well, who we did I did an interview with a couple of years back for this podcast, talking about sharpening. And there's so much to still understand about burrs and polishing and refining those burrs and maintaining those edges and what angle you sharpen at depending on the kind of work you're actually doing versus, so like a razor edge for shaving versus, being out in the woods and using a camp knife to chop down a tree. Like, not the same geometry, but why are they different geometry? And what is that geometry? And is it a convex or is it a flat grind? Or is it a hollow grind? What's the specific angle? All these different things. And some of that is learned through trial and error. But there's some pretty good information. Again, go check out, especially like Sean Houston. He's got a lot of great information about sharpening.
And if you've got a broadback, you could always buy the sharpening system.
That's right.
I mean, come on. If you don't have a broadback, why don't you have a broadback? They make fantastic grinders. We had Vince on the show just a couple of weeks ago. He was telling us about some of the stuff they've got coming up as well. It's sort of off mic. It's going to blow your socks off. And the thing is, everything sort of works with a broadback. They've got all these attachments and these different things that you can always upgrade. It's always great. Sorry, I just received a message from Jeff. I don't know what it is. Have you got that, Mareko?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Basically, it's a URL which I'm not going to click, but the URL sometimes tells you what's in it. So it's a New York Post post, and it's got nypost.com/ giant penis mowed into lawn at King Charles's coronation bash.
Perfect.
Okay, yeah, perfect. Anyway, back to broadback. They're fantastic grinders. As I say, everything sort of works with them. They've got all these upgrades and stuff that you can buy, and I know the future stuff that they're working on will continue to upgrade a broadback as well. So it's time-proof. It's time-proof. But if you haven't got one of their sharpening systems, you can get, I believe it's $100 off by using Knife Talk 100 at checkout.
Yes.
That also applies to their Cowboy sewing machine, and also their
surface grinder.
That's the one. The surface grinder. And also, if you use Knife Talk 200, you get $200 off one of the packages that they do, one of their grinder packages.
Right.
So they're affordable anyway, but they can be even more affordable as you're a lovely listener to this podcast.
Yeah, and they,
so go take a look.
They did post just in the last couple of days. They did post their Blade Show sale, so people can start thinking about that as well. They're going to have their super mega package at $590 off. It's going to be $4,075. Wow. And then their premium plus package is going to be $3,080, which is $445 off. And their max package is going to be $2,810, which is a savings of $215. So, if you are looking at those deals, are going to be pretty great for Blade Show. But you can still use the Knife Talk 100 to save on the sharpening system, the leather sewing machine, and the surface grinder, Knife Talk 100. But if I were you, I'd maybe wait until Blade Show if you're thinking you're going to get one of them packages, because, I mean, geez, the one is like almost $600 off. So that's pretty massive.
Wow. And Canadians and Australians, they've also got distributors there now as well.
Right.
So our good friends at maritimeknifesupply.com, they are now stockists of Broadbecks, as well as everything else. I mean, they do steel belts. Basically, everything that we promote on this show, they now have in stock there. So whether it's Rhino Wet or Combat Abrasives, they've got it all there. That's maritimeknifesupply.com. And they've also got offers on belts and stuff as well. So it's worth just having a look to see what they've got. Because whenever we mention anything, we'll get a little ping from Lauren saying, oh, I'm selling that now too. So they've got everything there, believe me. Maritimeknifesupply.com.
Sweet.
Okay, where were we? Valdo Vice. I think it's Valdo Vice. Question. Hey guys, I'm getting my first own workshop, and unfortunately, there's a wooden floor in it that I can't take out. I only do stock removal, so no forging, but I do want to do my own heat treatment in there. I know that forges sometimes used to have wooden floors too, so should I be worried? I was planning to put sheet steel and anti-slip tape on the floor around the dangerous areas. Thanks guys, have a great day. I'd do something personally. I had wooden floors in my old shop before I moved, and I didn't actually realize it was wooden floors. It was like a lino, and underneath was just the wooden boards. And I dropped a few knives on that, and it's not nice. First of all, obviously the lino just melts, but just seeing the burns in that wood immediately.
Right.
And in fact, one of the houses in the old village that I was here in France, they burned down like to the ground a couple of months ago.
Oh, yikes.
And I was told it was because of the wooden floors there. It was like ancient, you know, it was a sort of 400-year-old house, which had wooden floors in there. And these had dried out. So when a flame did actually, and went in, a spark had happened, or however it started, it didn't take long at all for this whole thing to go. And I'm talking like minutes, not hours, the whole house. It's like a bomb has just hit. There's a hole in the floor. It's, you know, it's bad. So yeah, do what you can, because the last thing you want is any sort of regret. I mean, what advice would you give there, Mareko? Hello, Mareko. Ah. Maybe Mareko has left the building. So that leaves just me. But I'd say, yeah, I mean, what you said, putting some sheet steel down would probably be a great idea. That. Or you can get those, you know, those heat-proof panels that you can put, like, panels that you put on the floor and, you know, put them together, those little squares. But just do something, because the last thing you want is regret. Okay. It's just me. Me on my own. Let's not talk cocks. Simple Works has also sent us a message. Hey guys, could you please share some tips on fitting guards for hidden tang knives? No, I don't do that. Sean Wilson, hey man, can I ask you a question? Not really that important, but I was wondering, is there a right way to do Damascus lay account? No, I don't do that. Bro D again. Hey fellas, recently bought a plunge pattern, got my grinder. What are your thoughts on it? A plunge pattern, sorry. Does it replace hand sanding or assist? Never used one, I don't know. Blades by Johnny. Hey guys, I have a question. 8-inch Damascus chef knife, how thick? I'd never done Damascus. There's a theme happening here, isn't it? I miss my co-hosts. I think I can call it a day anyway. We're what, hour and 20 minutes in? I can call it a day. Mareko, if you listen back, or if you can hear me, I don't even know if you can hear me. Every now and again, you know what it is? Every now and again, we get plagued by these technical issues, and it's just a real, real pain. And when there's three of us, it's never normally too bad because, you know, two can sort of take over and handle it. But when it's just me, it gets pretty difficult. So anyway, we'll be back next week. Hopefully all three of us, myself, Mareko, and Jeff. Until then, have a good one. Bye for now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big money on new windows now at Menards. Update your home with vinyl windows from Jeld-Wen. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on Jeld-Wen windows in store or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more window deals happening this week now at Menards. Save big.